Ezekiel chapter 29, prophecies against the south. Having pronounced the fate of the six nations to the east, west and north of Israel, the prophet now turns to deliver seven prophecies against the seventh of Israel's enemies, Egypt in the south. The fact that four chapters, 1/12 of the entire book of Ezekiel, consisting of some 100 verses, are devoted to prophecies about Egypt, should alert us to the importance of this nation in relation to Israel. At the meeting place of the two great continents of Africa and Asia, Egypt provided the world's greatest civilization until the rise of the Greeks. The history of God's chosen people became interwoven with that of Egypt from the time of Abraham. The Egyptians were descended from Mizraim, the son of Ham. Mizraim being the Hebrew word translated Egypt in the Old Testament. In fulfillment of the prophecy of Genesis 15, the nation of Israel came into being in Egypt, later being subject to Egyptian bondage, from which God delivered them by the hand of Moses. From the time of the Exodus to the reign of Solomon, there is no mention of contact between the two peoples. 1 Kings 3 records that Solomon made affinity with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and that he married Pharaoh's daughter. Relations between them appear to have become strained, for Pharaoh harbored Hadad, a Solomon's enemy. And it was to Egypt that Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, fled from Solomon, where he was sustained by Shishak, king of Egypt. And these events may well explain why, within 5 years of the death of Solomon, Shishak marched on Judah, spoiling the temple that Solomon had built. During the last days of the northern kingdom, Hoshea appealed to Pharaoh for help against Assyria, but there is no indication that his help was given. In the days of Hezekiah, Judah also appears to have looked in vain to Egypt for help, as may be inferred from 2 Kings 18 and as Isaiah 31. One of the outstanding pharaohs of this period was Necho II. Upon the decline of Assyria, he set out to re-establish Egypt's greatness. Jeremiah 47 refers to this time, speaking of his conquest of Philistia, and it was on the occasion of his subsequent northern thrust that Josiah went out against him and was killed at Megiddo. Necho II, having thus taken the whole of Syria, recovered the entire Egyptian empire at a stroke. Jehoahaz, son of Josiah, was deported to Egypt, and Jehoiakim was placed on the throne and compelled to pay tribute. In the fourth year of Jehoiakim, Necho II was defeated by Nebuchadnezzar at Carchemish on the Euphrates. And from then on, the king of Egypt came not again any more out of his land, for the king of Babylon had taken from the river of Egypt unto the river Euphrates all that pertained to the king of Egypt. The last king of Judah, Zedekiah, sent ambassadors to Egypt for help against Nebuchadnezzar. And when Pharaoh Hophra, also known in history as Apries, A-P-R-I-E-S, responded by sending an army, Nebuchadnezzar lifted his siege of Jerusalem and proceeded south to deal with Pharaoh before returning to complete the siege. And it was at this time that Ezekiel's first prophecy against Egypt was delivered. verse 1, the allegory. The prophecy was given in the 10th year of the captivity. And there's a footnote here to point out that these various prophecies in Ezekiel do not always follow in chronological order. And the footnote goes on to say that believing that they are chronological results in the unwarranted conclusion that the Gogian invasion in chapter 38 takes place after the kingdom established in the 37th chapter. So, the prophecy was given in the 10th year of the captivity, exactly 1 year after Nebuchadnezzar had begun the siege of Jerusalem, and would be given, therefore, approximately the same time as the events recorded in Jeremiah 37, when Pharaoh set out to help Zedekiah. The Pharaoh is Hophra, who, like Necho II, had great ambitions and dreamed of restoring Egypt to its former greatness. Hophra and his royal city of Sais, S-A-I-S, amidst the waters of the Nile Delta, is pictured as the great dragon that lieth in the midst of his rivers, verse 3. No doubt the references to the crocodiles, which according to Herodotus were to be found in the Nile at that time. The arrogance of Pharaoh, represented by this fearsome creature, can be traced to the fact that all the pharaohs consider themselves to be divine, that is, incarnations of the pagan deity Ra. Like a crocodile proudly parading the Nile, so Pharaoh, full of pride, surveyed the Nile-dependent Egypt and, in like vein to Nebuchadnezzar, declared, I have made it for myself. He too had yet to learn that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basest of men. Herodotus describes the way in which swine's flesh was placed on a hook by the riverside, and when the crocodile had swallowed the bait, he was pulled ashore and killed. This is the figure employed of Pharaoh in verse 4. His power would come to an end, and with it that of the fishes sticking to his scales, that is, the Egyptian people. Thus, like a crocodile drawn from the waters, his carcass dumped in the wilderness to be preyed on by the birds and the beasts, and Pharaoh's kingdom would come to the end of its glory. And verses 6 and 7 give the reason for these divine judgments, this time using the figure of the reed that grew abundantly by the side of the Nile. And as the above review of Egypt's historical relationship with Israel shows, Israel had on several occasions asked Egypt for help. The staff offered them by Egypt proved to be only a reed. It broke when leaned upon, the sharp end piercing the shoulder. Rabshakeh had rightly assessed the situation when Judah, in Hezekiah's day, approached Egypt for help. Thou trustest upon the staff of this bruised reed, even upon Egypt, on which if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So too now, Zedekiah's appeal for help to resist the forces of Nebuchadnezzar would produce nothing more than token support. Compare this with Ezekiel 17, verses 7 to 21. The next five verses are given an explanation of the allegory. Egypt would be invaded and subjected to a most humiliating defeat, and there would be great slaughter, and the land would be made desolate, and the pride of Egypt would thus be laid low. The phrase in verse 10 concerning the desolation of the land is best rendered as in the RV margin, I will make the land of Egypt an utter waste and desolation from Migdol to Syene, even unto the border of Ethiopia. Migdol was a town in the Nile Delta, and Syene is the modern Aswan. Ethiopia, or Kush, corresponds to modern Sudan, south of Egypt. Migdol to Syene would be then the Egyptian equivalent of the Hebrew from Dan to Beersheba. That is the entire extent of the land. Egypt would remain desolate for 40 years, verse 11, and during this time the Egyptian people would be scattered among the nations, verse 12. And Jeremiah 46 also refers to this desolation and captivity of Egypt. Egypt's restoration. Verse 13. The predictions in this section are bold. After the 40 years of desolation, the captivity of Egypt will come to an end. And the Egyptians would return into the land of Pathros, where the kingdom of Egypt began. Compare this with the Pathrusim of Genesis 10:14. Egypt would once more become a nation, but it would never attain to its former greatness. And throughout the remainder of its premillennial history would remain a base kingdom. And thus the broken reed upon which Israel from time to time had placed her confidence with such disastrous results would be no more the confidence of the house of Israel. Verse 16. Israel herself, disciplined by God and seeing the judgments poured out upon Egypt, would thereby accept that Yahweh was indeed Lord, the ruler among the nations. Regarding fulfillment, the prophecy is not without its difficulties. That Nebuchadnezzar was the instrument of judgment, the sword, verse 8, cannot be doubted. The words of Jeremiah are plain. I will deliver them into the hand of those that seek their lives, and into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of his servants. And in his next prophecy, Ezekiel also states unequivocally, I will give the land of Egypt unto Nebuchadnezzar, and that Nebuchadnezzar wrought havoc on Egypt and carried the Egyptians into captivity is further confirmed by Jeremiah 43. There are, in fact, more verses in prophecy regarding Nebuchadnezzar's invasion of Egypt than there are with respect to his invasion of Judah. There's an interesting footnote. Historical confirmation is meager, but comes down heavily in favor of the biblical record. Herodotus, who records the history of Egypt, makes no mention of a Babylonian conquest, but he is unreliable in this regard. He obtained his information from Egyptian priests, who would not have informed him of events that discredited their nation. This bias is illustrated by the fact that he records the success of Pharaoh Necho in the Battle of Megiddo, but does not mention his defeat at Carchemish. He does, however, mention that the fall of Apres, or Hophra, was due to an internal revolt in which the Egyptians themselves imprisoned and later killed Apres, putting Amasis on the throne. And this seems to be generally accepted. Josephus maintains another, that is, Amasis, was put on the throne by Nebuchadnezzar, although this is almost certainly not the case. But at least it shows an interest on the part of Nebuchadnezzar in Egyptian affairs at around the time Ezekiel leads us to expect it, and confirms that the judgments of God fell on Hophra exactly as Ezekiel predicted. There is a fragmentary cuneiform inscription by Nebuchadnezzar himself, now in the British Museum, that confirms Nebuchadnezzar's invasion of Egypt, and the significant part reads, "In the 37th year, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched against Egypt to deliver a battle." The remainder of the text is even more fragmentary, but it appears to refer to Amasis as the king of Egypt at the time of the invasion. At the time of this battle, the 37th year of Nebuchadnezzar, 568 to 567 BC, was just after Apres, or Hophra, was succeeded by Amasis. So, Josephus' mistake is understandable. Putting this apparently conflicting testimony together, it would appear that Apres was killed by Amasis, and that subsequently Egypt was invaded by Nebuchadnezzar and placed under tribute, although Amasis was left on the throne. W. H. Bolton, brother that is, makes the following interesting comment. Nebuchadnezzar went up the valley of the Nile as far as Elephantine, and on the way back completed the ravage of Egypt, but the course of his subsequent operations is unknown. Records of Nebuchadnezzar have been found in the Delta area, in the Isthmus of Suez, so that the fact of his invasion of Egypt is really beyond dispute. This is in Brother Bolton's book, Egypt. The period of 40 years' desolation of the land of Egypt presents us with one of the main problems of this section. The historical testimony with respect to the reign of Amasis is that he led Egypt into almost half a century of prosperity, engaging in the development of the economy at home and abroad. Thus, it would appear to be political desolation to which Ezekiel primarily refers. At the end of the reign of Amasis, Egypt tried to struggle out of the political wilderness for one brief moment. When Amasis sent an army of 120,000 to join with Croesus, king of Lydia, and Nabonidus of Babylon against Cyrus, king of the rising power of Persia, but to no avail. When Cambyses, son of Cyrus, later invaded Egypt, he met little opposition, and he dwelt ruthlessly with the Egyptians, removing any hope of independence they might have cherished. And by the time of this invasion by Cambyses, Psammetichus III had succeeded Amasis, and Cambyses executed him and established a new dynasty of Persian kings over Egypt. In the light of this, it is difficult to be dogmatic with respect to the 40 years period of Egypt's desolation. Certainly, the available historical testimony does not indicate a literal desolation of the land similar to that of Judah at the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. Most commentators give a symbolic meaning to the 40 years, and certainly Nebuchadnezzar's invasion marks the beginning of Egypt's entry into a political wilderness. However, it may well be that the figure refers to the period from the invasion by Nebuchadnezzar in 567 BC to the invasion by Cambyses in 525 BC. Not exactly 40 years, but it was only a matter of 2 years after the expiry of the 40-year period that the invasion by Cambyses took place. It is also worth noting that since we have no Historical details with respect to how long Nebuchadnezzar was involved in the subjugation of Egypt, it may well be that the 40-year period should be dated from some time after 567, that is, from the time when Egypt was actually conquered by Nebuchadnezzar. After Cambyses had executed Psammetichus III, Egypt did undergo a period of resurgence, but as would be expected from Ezekiel's prophecies, it was under Persian control. Once Cambyses had brought the Egyptians to heel, he and his successors exercised the typical Persian conciliatory policy towards Egypt, as towards all her subject peoples. Egypt remaining a base kingdom since that time is undeniable. Any hopes the Egyptians might have entertained of resurrecting her past greatness were dashed to the ground by Cambyses during the Persian period and Alexander the Great at the beginning of the Greek period. Macedonian rule until 305 BC was followed by the Ptolemies until 30 BC, when the Romans became supreme. Arabs, Turks, and Britons have all in turn dominated the nation of Egypt. And although in 1936 it became an independent nation, it remains a base kingdom. Verse 17, invasion predicted. This second of Ezekiel's seven prophecies regarding Egypt as Nebuchadnezzar's wages is chronologically the latest of all his prophecies being delivered, even after the vision of the temple in chapters 40 to 48. The last of the seven prophecies against Egypt was given in the 12th year, whereas this one is dated the 27th year of the captivity. The captivity referred to is, of course, Jehoiachin's captivity, which took place in 597 BC, and so the 7th and 20th year would be about 571 to 570 BC, which would be about the time of the conclusion of Nebuchadnezzar's campaign against Tyre. Presumably, this prophecy is placed at this point in the record because of its close connection with the events of the first prophecy, and it would appear from the dating that it was given at a time not long before the Babylonian armies brought upon Egypt the desolation predicted in the first prophecy. This prophecy makes it clear that the desolation of Egypt was to be accomplished by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, verse 18. He had been God's instrument in the judgment of Tyre, when for some 13 years he laid siege against the city, finally bringing it to submission as predicted in the prophecies of chapters 26 to 28. Nebuchadnezzar's forces had to work very hard to bring about the subjugation of Tyre, even to the extent of every head being made bald by the constant wearing of a helmet, and every shoulder peeled by the bearing of burdens for the construction of the siege works. For all this, the king of Babylon had received no wages. The fall of Tyre did not produce its anticipated rewards. For many of that city made their escape by sea, taking their most precious possessions with them. As noted in the comments on Ezekiel 26, Egypt was to be God's wages to Nebuchadnezzar for his service against Tyre. The land of the Pharaohs would be desolated by the king of the north who would come, and carrying the Egyptians captive would spoil them of their riches. Verse 19. Which had been accumulated by the considerable commercial activities of the kings of the 26th dynasty. We've already noted that this prediction of Egypt's conquest by Nebuchadnezzar had also been made by Jeremiah, and it will be recalled that after the fall of Jerusalem in 587 BC, a remnant of Israel remained in the land, and after the murder of Gedaliah, they were intent on going down to Egypt because they feared the Chaldeans. And Jeremiah warned them that if they did go into Egypt, then the sword which you feared shall overtake you there in the land of Egypt, and the famine. This warning went unheeded. The remnant went into Egypt, taking Jeremiah with them. And in Egypt, he continued to warn them, and like Ezekiel, who was in Babylon, predicted that Nebuchadnezzar would be God's instrument of judgment against Egypt. Jeremiah 43 says, I will send the king of Babylon my servant, and will set his throne upon these stones, and when he cometh, he shall smite the land of Egypt, and deliver such as are for death to death, and such as are for captivity to captivity, and such as offer the sword to the sword, and I will kindle a fire in the houses of the gods of Egypt, and he shall burn them, carry them away captives, and he shall array himself with the land of Egypt as a shepherd putteth on his garment, and you shall go forth from thence in peace. Thus up to, that was Jeremiah 43, and there's also more detail in the 44th and 46th chapters. We refer at length to Jeremiah's prophecies to demonstrate how clearly both he and Ezekiel predicted with unmistakable clarity that Egypt would be invaded and conquered by Nebuchadnezzar. In the previous chapter, we noted the scant but definite reference in profane history to the invasion of Egypt by Nebuchadnezzar. In spite of this, Cook, G.A. Cook, in his book on Ezekiel, reaches the conclusion that there is no evidence that the Babylonians inflicted the complete disaster which Ezekiel had foretold, and again, his prophecy was not fulfilled, at any rate, not in the way expected. But there are none so blind as those who will not see, as is illustrated by two contributors to the Cambridge Ancient History. The first of these, H.R. Hall, comments, we have no warrant to suppose that the Babylonian king, who was now growing old, ever carried out the great warlike operations against Amasis, far less that he conquered or even entered Egypt, either personally or by proxy. The second, who was R. Campbell Thompson, in that same book, faced presumably with the same documentary evidence, wrote, the great campaign of Nebuchadnezzar's later years was directed against Egypt in retaliation for the trouble caused by Hophra. The small fragment of Babylonian chronicle first published by Pinches shows that Nebuchadnezzar launched an expedition against Egypt in his 37th year, that is, about 567 BC. Thus, while it remains true that we have no detailed, profane, historical confirmation as to the extent of the conquest of Egypt by Nebuchadnezzar, there is ample historical confirmation that the invasion did take place. And some of this evidence was presented earlier. We quoted there from W. H. Bolton, who noted that records of Nebuchadnezzar have been found in the delta area of Egypt in the Isthmus of Suez, confirming that he did actually invade Egypt. We may now add to this the fact that Urquhart, that's John Urquhart in the New Biblical Guide, refers to two Babylonian cylinders, the only two yet known, which bear an Egyptian inscription, and both of them bear the name of Hofra in Egyptian hieroglyphics. It seems likely that these cylinders were executed by Egyptian prisoners carried off to Babylon in this campaign. There's a footnote here. This confirms the truth of the prediction in verse 12 that the Egyptians were to be scattered among the nations. For these cylinders were found in Babylon. Even S.R. Driver, in his Authority in Archaeology, one of the most critical of Old Testament scholars, was compelled to admit the evidence that is available. There exist inscriptions showing what had previously been doubted, that Nebuchadnezzar invaded Egypt, thereby fulfilling, at least in their general sense, for we do not know whether the fulfillment extended to details, the predictions of Jeremiah, uttered shortly after 586, and of Ezekiel, and he cites Ezekiel 29:19, compared with verses 8 to 12, uttered in 570. Thus, continuing Brother Allfree's book now, thus archaeology has repeatedly confirmed and continues to confirm the Bible's historical and prophetic accuracy. And the student of the scriptures can have absolute confidence that the Bible record is reliable. Verse 21, the Horn of Israel. Having pronounced the impending invasion of Egypt, where it must be remembered, the remnant of Israel had fled against the advice of Jeremiah, the prophet now turns to Israel and gives them a message of hope. Egypt's judgment, and therefore the judgment of the Jews who had fled there for refuge, would not mean that God's purpose with them would not be fulfilled. Yahweh would cause the horn of the house of Israel to bud forth in that day. Verse 21. There is undoubtedly in these words a reference to the covenant that God made with David. In his last words, David rehearses his confidence in the covenant and declares, although my house be not so with God, yet he hath made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and sure. For this is all my salvation, all my desire, although he make it not to grow. The Hebrew word samak, translated to grow, is the same word rendered to bud forth in Ezekiel 29. It is interesting to trace this word samak through scripture and to observe its frequent connection with the covenant with David. Jeremiah speaks of the time when God would raise unto David a righteous branch. Again, the Hebrew is Tzimak. And he shall reign as king. A rather righteous branch is C-mac, T-S-E, whereas to grow is Samac, T-S-A. Raise unto David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely, and shall execute judgment and justice in the land. In his days Judah shall be saved, and Israel shall dwell safely. This is Jeremiah 23, verses 5 and 6 in the Revised Version. Thus, the one who was to bud or grow up, Samac, in David's house, becomes known as the branch, Semac. And in chapter 33, Jeremiah uses the verb and the noun. In those days and at that time will I cause the branch, Semac, of righteousness to grow up, Samac, unto David. And Zechariah too speaks of David's descendant in this way. Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, behold, the man whose name is the branch, Semac, and he shall grow up, Samac, out of his place, and he shall build the temple of the Lord. A footnote here, a clear reference to he shall build a house for my name in the covenant in 2 Samuel 7. Isaiah makes a beautiful allusion to this son of David, referring first to the Davidic covenant. The invitation is given. Incline your ear and come unto me. Hear, and your soul shall live. And I will make an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David. He then proceeds in his 55th chapter, then, to speak of this work of salvation that God would achieve through the one referred to in the covenant. For as the rain cometh down from heaven and returneth not thither, but watereth the earth and maketh it bring forth and bud, Samac, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing whereto I sent it. The word, or logos, went forth and became flesh. Thus the earth was made to bud, and Jesus, Son of God and Son of David, was the result. He faithfully performed the work entrusted to him by his Father, so that the word prospered in the thing whereto God sent it. And from the standpoint of Ezekiel 29, the most interesting reference to this growing up unto David of the promised seed is to be found in Psalm 132. Here the idea of him being the horn of the house of Israel is also present. First we note the covenant context. The Lord has sworn in truth unto David, he will not turn from it. The fruit of thy body will I set upon thy throne. The center of this divinely appointed rulership was to be Zion. The Lord hath chosen Zion, he hath desired it for his habitation, and of this place God declares, there will I make the horn of David to bud, Hebrew Samac. I have ordained a lamp for mine anointed. His enemies will I clothe with shame, but upon himself shall his crown flourish. In view of this very clear background to the words of Ezekiel, it is difficult to insist that in that day, that is the time when the horn of the house of Israel would bud forth, verse 21, must refer to the time when Nebuchadnezzar invaded Egypt. could be that there is a general reference to those days in that it was during the 40 years of Egypt's desolation that as a result of the decree of Cyrus, Zerubbabel, David's descendant, led the exiles back to the land. This was an important and necessary step, leading ultimately to the appearance of Messiah. And note that the genealogies of Luke and Matthew converge in Zerubbabel. In that sense, the appearance of Zerubbabel could be viewed as a budding forth of the horn of the house of Israel. Certainly Ezekiel was given an opening of the mouth in the eyes of the returning exiles, who would have been compelled to acknowledge that his prophecies were indeed the word of Yahweh, and that Yahweh who had spoken through him was the true God. However, the messianic application is put beyond all doubt by the reference to the Davidic covenant by Zacharias, the father of John the Baptist. He describes Jesus as an horn of salvation for Israel and as the branch, the Greek anatol, the equivalent of the Hebrew semach, from on high. This work of salvation commenced by Messiah is by no means finished. He has grown up as the branch, but does not rule on the throne of his father David. When this happens, Ezekiel will be given an opening of the mouth as the nation of Israel comes to see the wonderful way in which his prophecies of judgment and restoration have been wonderfully fulfilled. And then they will, in the fullest sense, come to acknowledge that I am the Lord. Verse 21. And see chapter 39, verse 28. There are several footnotes we've skipped. Going back to how that Jesus faithfully performed the work entrusted to him by his Father, so the word prospered in the thing whereto God sent it. There's a footnote here. There are other references in Isaiah to the growing up of the son of David to fulfill the covenant. For example, 42:9 and 43:19. Where Samach is rendered spring forth and refers to the things of the new covenant that would replace the former things of the old covenant dispensation. As regards the, in the sense of Zerubbabel could be In that sense, the appearance of Zerubbabel could be viewed as a budding forth of the horn of the house of Israel. There's a footnote. There are those who would see in the statement, "In that day will I cause the horn of the house of Israel to bud forth," a simple reference to the reversal of Israel's fortunes at the decree of Cyrus. But the scriptural connections of the horn and the budding forth with the son of David seem to be overwhelmingly in favor of the view set out. And then in that phrase, Ezekiel was given an opening of the mouth. There's a footnote that this cannot refer to the termination of the prophet's dumbness, since this is said to have happened in the 12th year of the captivity, whereas this prophecy was not given until the 27th year. And final footnote regarding Zacharias, who described Jesus as an horn of salvation for Israel and as the branch. Greek Anatole, the equivalent of the Hebrew Tzemach, from on high. This is clarified by the theological word book of the Old Testament. The New Testament makes at least two references to this messianic title, branch, using the Septuagint translation of the root, Anatole and Anatello. And so we come to the end of Ezekiel chapter 29.